Hey, it's Ryan Russillo. I'm the host of the Ryan Russillo Podcast at The Ringer. We are a sports show, but we do it a little differently because we want to cut through all of the nonsense and try to figure out what's really happening and give you those bigger picture observations. Do a lot of NFL, a lot of NBA, and of course, college football. Also have a great guest lineup, a lot of athletes, front office guys, and even we do some actors and writers from famous TV shows and movies, plus our life advice segment at the end of every show. So make sure you follow The Ryan Russillo Show on Spotify.
This episode is brought to you by Max. The new HBO original limited series, The Sympathizer, is an espionage thriller and cross-culture satire that follows a communist spy during the final days of the Vietnam War and his new life as a refugee in Los Angeles. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr. and based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel, The Sympathizer is streaming now exclusively on Max. Tap the banner or visit this episode's page to learn more. This episode is brought to you by Vuori. I love sports. I know you do too. I also know that lots of you exercise, but if you're like me and my wife, the beloved sports gal, you're sick and tired of ugly, uncomfortable workout gear. Especially, you know, I do a lot of walking. I walk around LA. I make calls. I listen to podcasts. Here are two words that will change everything. Vuori clothing. A line of activewear that is unbelievable. The best thing about Vuori is you can lounge around in it. You can work out in it. You can go outside. You can go shopping down in your local wherever. And you never feel like you're either underdressed or overdressed. You're just comfortable. You can wear it when you're training, traveling, lounging around the house. Go get yourself some of the most comfortable and versatile clothing on the planet. Here's the deal. Our listeners get 20% off their first purchase at Vuori.com/Simmons. Once again, Vuori.com/Simmons.
It is Wednesday, January 25th. Coming at you live, recording this at the Sundance Film Festival. It's really the dream of every young filmmaker. You scrape together enough money for your first movie, gets into Sundance, you show up, it plays through the roof, there's an all-night bidding war, and boom, you sell your first movie to a deep-pocketed distributor and launch your directing career. It's happened to everyone from Rian Johnson to Ryan Coogler to Chloe Zhao, Damien Chazelle. Hundreds of filmmakers have come to Sundance and left major talents. Precious, Napoleon Dynamite, Little Miss Sunshine, more recently Palm Springs, and last year's Best Picture winner, Coda, all sold at Sundance for big numbers. But over the past decade or so, that dream has begun shifting a bit. When I first started coming to Sundance in the mid-2000s, the goal was to convince a Fox Searchlight or Paramount Vantage or another of the big specialty divisions of the major studios to pick up your Sundance movie, release it in theaters, hopefully get some awards buzz, and turn it into a major box office hit. These days, the biggest Sundance buyers are streamers. Netflix, we saw this past weekend, bought a movie called Fair Play, kind of modern Fatal Attraction. It premiered on Friday, and by Monday, there was a sale at a reported $20 million, although I've heard it's a little less than that. The Sundance market, as it's called, is still alive and well. It's just different than it used to be, and in many ways, more challenging. One constant over the past 40 years of the festival has been the presence of John Sloss. I've known John for years. He's a lawyer, a deal maker, media advisor in the indie space, a manager to filmmakers. He's produced movies like Boyhood, the 2014 Best Picture nominee. And he and his company, Synetic Media, have generally been in the middle of some of the biggest Sundance sales in the festival's history. He's pretty outspoken. He tells a great story about escaping to the middle of a snowy field amid the bidding war for Little Miss Sunshine back in 2006. And he's concerned about certain areas of the film business these days. He actually says he wouldn't invest in a company doing scripted independent dramas right now. It's pretty surprising coming from a guy who often sells these movies. So I wanted to have him in today to have a conversation about the changing Sundance deal market, whether it's time to freak out about the future of these challenging art house movies, and whether that Sundance dream is still alive. From The Ringer and Puck, I'm Matt Bellany, and this is The Town. All right, we are here with John Sloss, lawyer, dealmaker, manager, media advisor, all-around man about Sundance. You sold more movies at Sundance than anyone, right?
I think I've been doing it longer, and yes, I think by this point I've sold more movies than anyone at Sundance.
That's impressive. Yeah, we won't go into like the stories of, you know, Sundance in the 80s, but I'm sure it was wild.
Pretty nutty.
So you and others are responsible for this whole narrative that we are all taught about Sundance, which is the dream. that you can be a nobody filmmaker. You can scrape together the cash to make your movie, bring it to Sundance, gets in, and you take it to a screening, bidding war all night, and all of a sudden you are Ryan Coogler or Damien Chazelle or Chloe Zhao or Rian Johnson. Is that dream still alive?
Yes.
But it's different.
Sundance, more than any other festival, is a festival of discovery, and it's remained very true to it, to that aspect of itself, with all the ambush marketing around the periphery over the years. At the core, it's very much the same festival.
So the curation is still strong. That's yes. basically what it is.
Yes.
With all the politics that goes into the selection of the lineup and all of the issues that they have around representation and, you know, doing an agent a favor, they still manage to get a top quality lineup every year.
I agree with that.
You do?
That is, yes, I do. I would back that statement.
I've seen too many bad Sundance movies to fully agree with you, but I will say, especially on the doc side, you will never see better films than you will on Sundance.
This is by far the best doc festival in the world, and it's a festival where docs have at least parity with scripted films,
right.
And there's no other elite festival in the world that's even close to that.
Yeah. So having said that, how has that Sundance dream changed, especially given the market and post-pandemic, and this is the first festival back after 3 years? So, you know, how have you noticed that dream changing?
Well, we're still sort of figuring out what the lasting effects of the pandemic are. You know, this is the first in-person festival in 3 years at Sundance. And it's, I think it's been affected more than anything by the theatrical marketplace,
right.
Because the streamers, it's interesting because the economy there is that the streamers are interested in the documentaries and the documentary equivalent of the Discovery scripted films, but they're much less interested in those Discovery scripted films.
Right, for theatrical especially. All those filmmakers I mentioned, their films that went to Sundance scored a theatrical deal and were hits in theaters pretty much. And they've spawned theatrical film careers.
Well, that's what I'm saying. I'm saying the streamers are much less interested in those films. And the theatrical all rights distributors have been challenged to get those audiences back to the theaters.
And you're seeing that in the deal market. They're less willing to take a chance on a Sundance movie that would have previously been a theatrical play because they know theatrical is so challenged.
That's exactly right. And which is why... ever adaptable, we have leaned into the documentary market, at least here at this festival.
Right, because you can still get a number for those movies, even though they are streaming plays.
I mean, we sold Summer of Soul for $15 million.
And that went to Searchlight that put it out on Hulu.
It really went to Onyx, mm-hmm.
which is another division of Disney.
Initiative in Disney for Searchlight and Hulu. Mm-hmm. But yes, it did not have a robust theatrical
and it play. Won the Oscar, which is all, you know, the big goal of all these documentary films.
That it is disproportionately important.
Is it true that Netflix paid $20 million for that documentary here about the guy who holds his breath, the people who hold their breath scuba diving?
They didn't buy it here.
No, they bought it before. But $20 million for a doc, is that a real thing?
You know, I would argue it's hard because Netflix is still a little bit of a black box from a data sharing standpoint. But when you press these streamers to say, you know, are the eyeballs there for docs to justify those kind of numbers? Routinely, they won't give you a robust yes, but they won't deny it.
Interesting. Well, especially with Netflix, they have the relationship with the Obamas and they can slap their name on it and then they can get people to see it because of that. They've done that a number of times.
And Harry and Meghan.
Are they putting their name on docs?
They put their name on a doc series that I just did, yeah.
Oh, interesting. What was it called?
It's called Live to Lead.
Interesting. I don't know that will hold the same sway with Oscar voters as the Obamas.
Well, it's a series. right. Yeah, well, there you go. We sold Descendant last year to Higher Ground, which is the Obamas company.
Right. And that is currently on Netflix. I watched that. It's good.
It's very good, yeah.
Okay. So let's get back a little bit to the Sundance dream for filmmakers. You must manage expectations a lot. When you take on a client and bring their film to Sundance, you must say, you know, listen, this is not going to be Little Miss Sunshine. I'm not going to be in the middle of a field you know, taking call after call, trying to, you know, bid up the price to 20 million.
Hiding out at the Ruby Tuesdays by the interstate.
Right. This is more likely in this market. You're going to go, the goal is a streamer will be interested, maybe a couple million, you know, you'll make your money back and the film will get a release.
Yeah. I am famously bad at under-promising and over-delivering. I find that really annoying. So I tend to get hyped myself.
Really?
Because I'm from a family of salesmen, and it's... so
but
I don't,
then what happens when you're like, oh,
I don't really manage expectations.
It's Friday at the festival, you haven't sold, and the filmmaker's freaking out.
Well, you know, I mean, look, I was there during the day and probably a central figure in it when you could create urgency and you could make deals overnight like Little Miss Sunshine. Mm-hmm. And even Precious more recently and you know, and other films. But the market has become elongated. It just has. It has.
What does that mean? Meaning there's no all-night bidding war. It's just...
I mean, it's unusual.
Right.
I think Fair Play was the closest thing to it.
Yeah, we just saw this festival that film Fair Play from... is it a first-time filmmaker?
It is Chloe a first-time. I believe she's a first-time.
And with Alden Ehrenreich and Phoebe... But Phoebe Dareton is her name?
It did have Rian Johnson's company behind it.
Oh, it did? Oh, okay. Well, yeah. Good for that. But my point is, this movie, Fair Play, got a huge response in its opening night screening. Netflix came in, bid, you know, whatever number you want to believe, $15 to $20 million, got the film. That's the success story. That is a real filmmaker. Now, will that filmmaker get the same bump in her career without a theatrical release? That's a whole separate conversation.
It is. There will invariably be more eyeballs on that film than there would have been with a traditional theatrical release. But what you say is a real possibility that because it's a closed circuit unit, you know, just for subscribers,
right,
there's less outward promotion. I mean, Netflix does a very good job of creating awareness. You know, they buy a lot of billboards and
in LA, New York,
and the area code of the where the director lives.
Right, exactly. So you see it on the way to the market every day. But yeah, and if they anoint your movie an awards movie, they will promote the crap out of it.
They spend money
on documentaries to promote them like you've never seen, but only a small few that they think will win awards.
Yes. They're very good at focusing on the good chances that they have.
Can you work that into deals? Can you say, yes, we will sell to you, but we want a $3 million Oscar campaign?
Yes, you can. You can't always do it. And there's, as you're trained as a lawyer, there's weasel language often that allows them, if they're just not feeling it or if they're not getting traction.
Good faith effort. Yeah. Best effort.
Best effort makes everyone nervous.
Right, exactly. All right, so you were on the IndieWire podcast recently and you said something very interesting that caught my ear. You said, you wouldn't be an investor right now in a scripted drama movie company. You don't know how to make money there.
I did. I may have said that just to clarify it. I would scripted. I work in scripted movies all day, every day, and they are still being made. It's really, I'm talking about the scripted movies that are first time films for Sundance, and it was really set in the context.
So budgets under $10 million.
Budgets under. Under 2 million. With
okay.
Movies that aren't a tried and true genre or don't have sort of bankable names.
Right.
So that are completely execution dependent.
Or Fruitvale Station or these kinds of movies that made careers for these filmmakers. You would not invest in those kinds of movies now.
I mean, look, if I knew, when I saw Brick, I knew what it was, and I went all in and I sold it and I went all in for it. If I knew that Rian Johnson had that promise or, then possibly I would make the exception for that. But the thing is, because the theatrical is so uncertain now and because the streamers are not looking for these kinds of first-time films without stars, typically, it is a tough business decision for an investor, for first-time filmmakers. And I mentioned in the podcast some fixes to the investment structure that could possibly, because when you're investing in a first-time film, you're not really investing in the film, you're investing in the filmmaker. Mm-hmm. So if there was a way to get a carried interest in the work of that filmmaker.
We got your next three.
Yeah, or even I analogize it to NFT smart contracts where the filmmaker goes on, you know, like Colin Trevorrow would do Safety Not Guaranteed and then Jurassic Park 3 or whatever he did.
Right.
You have a carried interest to the extent you don't recoup off of the independent film to what they get paid for a certain amount of time for these other films as their career's blowing up.
Yeah, so if you invest in Whiplash, you get La La Land.
You don't get La La Land. You get a revenue stream from what Damien Chazelle gets from La La Land.
That movie made almost $500 million, so I'm imagining his revenue was decent.
I mean, this is sort of a downside protection thing. This isn't a way to sort of cash in, but it's a way to bring rationality for first-time investors so that it's not just philanthropy.
Right. And you also potentially start that relationship that can last an entire career.
Which I think is right.
You did that with Richard Linklater, correct?
Well, I didn't invest in him, but it's funny because I said—
But you represented him from the beginning.
I said to him, if I came to you on Slacker and said, I will fund this film, all of $23,000 on it, if you'll give me 10% of a carried interest in what you earn for the next 5 years in Dazed and Confused and Before Sunrise, and he goes, I would have done that in a second.
Hmm. And then, you know, 25 years later, you're a producer on Boyhood, which in my opinion should have won the Oscar that year.
Please. It's everyone's opinion. They don't give an Oscar to the best film. They give it to the best campaign. And we were outgamed by Nancy Utley.
Even she
would admit that. The woman,
she ran Searchlight, and they had a very good film that year as well, the Guillermo del Toro film. That was Shape of Water, wasn't it?
No.
Birdman.
It was Birdman.
Oh, that was the Birdman year.
Yeah, it was Iñárritu.
Right, it was Iñárritu. I like that movie too.
Yeah, but next to Boyhood.
Boyhood was, I think, more of an accomplishment. Like, it's just an amazing thing to watch someone age on screen naturally like that. I mean, these days, we did a whole show about it last week. You could do that but with computers.
Yeah, right.
It was great. I love that movie.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
So you kind of have a unique role in that you are selling films. You're also managing filmmakers. You also consult for some of the companies that are buying these films. How do you deal with your role in all different aspects of the deal equation? Well, Sometimes you're selling to yourself.
I don't deal with it the way Alan Grubman once said, no conflict, no interest.
Right. Well, clearly there are conflicts sometimes, but—
I mean, conflicts, people sort of react reflexively about conflicts, but you know, as a lawyer, as long as it's disclosed and waived, it's not necessarily a big deal. If you're inherently, you know, I mean, honest is a charged word, but principled, and you're dealing with intelligent individuals and they have all the information, then sometimes there's not enough at play in a specific deal to have each person have their own representation. And the deal's best served by one group or person putting it together.
And you're often dealing with the same people on the other side anyways.
Yes. And hopefully—
It's a very small world.
Hopefully our reputation, you know, speaks in our favor.
Right. You can fuck someone over once and then they don't forget.
I did get sued by Harvey for Precious, which was interesting.
Oh, right. I remember that. I covered that. So what was his argument there?
His argument, basically, he has the greatest lawyers in the world. David Boies.
Not great. He's currently in prison for the rest of his life, but so not great. Not the greatest lawyers in the world.
Yeah, well, a good lawyer knows when to call it a day.
Yeah.
Yes. His argument was that because— He sent an offer and we said, we will discuss this with our clients and get back to you. And our sign off at the end was best. And they made the argument that by signing an email with the word best, it indicated a predisposition to enter into a contract.
That is an enforceable contract, the word best. And it didn't
As
work.
The judge said when he dismissed it out of hand, the argument strained credulity.
Yeah, and that's probably not even nearly the weirdest or craziest Harvey Weinstein lawsuit over a movie. So
no,
I've covered a lot of those.
No.
So separate topic here. You've got a hot film, let's say, and you've got two offers on the table. Same money. One is a streamer. One is a theatrical release. Which one do you pick these days?
I mean, it might surprise you to hear, but I work for the filmmaker. So my job is to basically, and I really, this is a controversial statement a little bit. I always tell my people, we're not really selling films to acquisitions people. We're selling films to the marketing people because they've got, it's their job to get it out in the world. They're sort of the broker, the middleman. So honestly, I would sit my filmmaker down with each company. I would say, okay, you've expressed interest in our film. We've put a year or two into it. What are you going to do to justify, from a marketing standpoint, what we've created?
And in those meetings, what's effective? What things that they say are effective to you?
I mean, passion is always the most effective.
But how do they, I mean, everybody is going to be nice. Is it the number of people they bring to the meeting? Is it the specifics they can tell you? We will do this, this, this. Or is it just a feeling?
Yeah. I mean, Netflix is famous for showing up like the day after they see a film with like 10 comps for key art and things like that.
So they have a poster already to show you.
That's a little stunty for me. Mm-hmm. You know, and as you say, everyone's nice. There's a difference between being nice and being passionate and smart. Mm-hmm. And if you've really given a film some thought, you know, each film, there is a best way to market each film. A film is unique. And there are specific audiences for it, and there are specific ways to sell it to critics and to the public. And there, you know, yes, there are financial commitments. That's obviously very important. Mm-hmm. But like I said, you know, streamers in some ways get a bad rap. I mean, I wish they were more transparent with their data, but you're invariably going to have that film seen by more people in Netflix than you will with a platform theatrical release.
And do most of your clients agree with that and want that? Or do they still hold out for that dream of turning their movie into the next Brick or Fruitvale station?
You know, it's horses for courses. It is, some filmmakers feel some ways, others feel. I think increasingly filmmakers are less absolutely wedded to the theatrical experience.
And is it just the number?
It's not just the number. I mean, I think everything I've said for the last 3 minutes would indicate that it's not.
So you, how often do you represent filmmakers who pass on more money? Percentage?
Only once.
No, really?
No, I mean, I don't work with them after that.
Oh, that's funny.
It's a joke. It's unusual. Yes. I mean, that is a very important factor.
Right. 5 years, what does the Sundance Film Festival look like? And are we still talking about it as the curation monster that it is?
I mean, the pandemic really put a focus on longer narratives, you know, in terms of episodic, limited episodic stuff. And festivals have been trying to get their head around that.
They program television now.
Yeah.
I mean, series.
It's still pretty peripheral.
Yeah.
I think documentaries will still be just as important as features. I'm hoping that the theatrical, you know, distributors who've stayed in business and even flourished in the case of A24 and Neon and some of the old war horses, mm-hmm. or at least survived during the pandemic, really come back strong. And I'd love to see a world, you know, as I also said, I don't know if this is controversial or not, but it surprises everybody. When you look at 2023 and you look at the aggregate content budgets of the seven streamers, it really comes out to about $120 billion. And that is just a mind-numbing number.
Yeah, but they're not giving that money to you. They're giving $200 million to the Russo brothers to make whatever nonsense
Well, I like the Russo brothers. But they routinely will pay $200 million for what historically had been a $50 to $70 million film because they have to spend that money. I'd like to think of giving some of it to me.
I imagine the price for Descendant was not cheap.
You have a vivid imagination. but it wasn't. You're correct. If the all rights distributors come back and the streamers stay in this sort of arms race to just be a surviving global entity, which mm-hmm. is really what this is.
Yeah, but they've had pullbacks, at least on the market front. I mean, these companies are worth half what they were a year or two ago.
What's the correlation between that?
Is there really a correlation?
About the subs and the churn.
It's about the profitability these days as well. So that's the question is, are they going to pull back?
From a stock standpoint, listen, this is a race where pulling back isn't really going to work for you because you have to, in 5 to 7 years, either be bought, be the surviving entity that's one of the five global streamers mm-hmm. that people subscribe to, or go out of business. So they can talk about pulling back. They can talk about serving, you know, their shareholders or, you know, what Warner Discovery is doing and what Netflix, you know, did in terms of a correction. But I don't really think that's what it's about. I think that's sort of a misdirect.
Well, and they can continue to pay $20 million for the films by your clients.
Yes. One would certainly hope.
All right, John Sloss, thanks for joining us. Appreciate the time.
My pleasure, Matt.
All right, we are back with the call sheet. Craig, did you watch any of the Ticketmaster Taylor Swift hearings yesterday in the Senate Judiciary Committee?
I did not watch any of it live.
Did you catch that?
No. However, I saw all of the senators making their Taylor Swift puns, which went viral.
It was so cringeworthy. Just awful. Like you want to just jump out the window. Senator Richard Blumenthal, Democrat of Connecticut, said, and I'm quoting here, "Ticketmaster ought to look in the mirror and say, I'm the problem. It's me." Oh.
There were a lot of good puns. There was like five of them. And it spanned her entire career. It was as yes. recent as her newest album. And it went all the way back to kind of her OG days. Why were they doing this?
Because it's all for the cameras. Listen, they probably went to their junior staffers and said, give me a compendium. Give me your best Taylor Swift quotes. This was all this here. And this is actually my prediction. My prediction is this goes nowhere. I don't think that they will actually follow up on Ticketmaster at all because nobody has done anything about Ticketmaster since it merged with Live Nation in 2010. But they do this so that they can win some points. I mean, you look at this Senator Marsha Blackburn. She's literally screaming at the president of Live Nation in this hearing and saying how awful it is that they had bots attacking these ticket buyers. It's for the cameras. Everybody likes Taylor Swift. Everybody wants to get tickets. They didn't get tickets, and now their congressman or their senator is standing up for them in front of the CEO or the president of Ticketmaster.
Interesting.
We've discussed it on the show. We've had Lucas and I discussing this, and there are some serious antitrust issues with how Ticketmaster and Live Nation operate. I mean, it's bizarre that the most dominant concert promoter can own the most dominant ticket seller. And yes, we've discussed it. They do compete in different areas, but big picture, it just has always kind of smelled bad. And yeah. Ticketmaster is just one of those companies that everybody kind of hates. So it makes sense that this would happen in Congress. This is just a wrist slapping. Nothing's going to happen.
But what you and Lucas outlined, though, Ticketmaster is not setting the price. That is still Taylor Swift. It's
yes,
Ticketmaster
yes,
is
yes.
in charge of the selling of the tickets. That's all.
Yes. And the fees, you know, everyone hates the fees, and that the venues are mostly responsible for the fees being so high. It's just, it all contributes to a stink around buying tickets for events. And that's what these elected representatives are jumping on because they know. I mean, this was bipartisan. That's the crazy thing. You had Democrats and Republicans who never agree on these committees. They were all jumping in and attacking. So it's, you know, if this does move forward, the only reason is because it's so bipartisan. But I am just so cynical about whether they're going to do anything. They got their political points. They got on the local news. They quoted Taylor Swift and everybody went viral with it. So they're on the right side of this issue. And I just don't think anything's going to happen. I should also say that if this were ever to go anywhere, it would probably be during the Biden administration because he has shown a willingness to go after these large antitrust cases. I mean, the Justice Department just sued Google. The Biden administration stepped in to block a merger of two publishing houses on antitrust grounds. So there is appetite there, increased appetite than maybe, you know, 4 or 5 years ago. But I still just don't think that anyone has the fortitude to go after Ticketmaster like this.
This was my favorite old person trying to relate to young people pun since Hillary Clinton said Pokemon go to the polls.
Nice.
That was the best one. That's still top. That's still first of the last 10 years.
Was that a formative moment in your upbringing?
When did that happen? I guess when she was running, 2016?
Sure.
That was just elite in the group chat for
it,
everybody.
It blew your mind. It won over hearts and minds of the Pokemon generation.
It did. It made all of us Pokemon go to the polls.
Right. All right. That's the show for today. I want to thank John Sloss for coming on. I want to thank producer Craig Horlbeck. I want to thank Craig's hand warming system that he's got going with his hand warmers. And I want to thank you. We'll see you tomorrow.
Those hand warmers are a revelation. Nobody uses those enough.